Well, we have a real treat here with us today. We have Dr. Wilson here. I asked him how he wanted me to introduce him, and he said, he's a shy, bashful guy. I always think it's kind of fun that, David is a real big guy, and it's really kind of fun that David and Arnold see things eye to eye. They're both really good guys. I'd like to tell the story how the first time that I met Dr. Wilson. We were busy building a dome. I think it was in Rock. We were in South Bend, Indiana. We were building a church there that was 16 feet. It was under 16 feet, had been cleared out, and it was a big dome, 180, 190 foot or something like that. And I was on the crew, and they had rented a house for us to stay in. And what that means is that your suitcase goes in the corner, and there's a mattress laid on the floor, and if you have a sleeping bag that keeps you warm at night, that's about it. And so there was kind of a hush go through the crew as we heard that Dr. Wilson was arriving on the scene. He was coming to visit. Dr. Wilson's going to be here. The guru of the domes, he's coming here. And I was sitting on my bed, laying on the floor kind of thing. And here come in Dr. Wilson. And he spent the night in the same room that I did, laying on the same floor. And I realized that Dr. Wilson got up in the morning, stretched, put his pants on the same way I did, and found out that he was about as normal as a person as they can be. I really have a lot of respect for him because of what he's done, being just a natural Gerald just like you and I. So, without further ado, I'd like to introduce to you, your friend of mine, guru extraordinaire in the engineering world, Dr. Arnold Wilson.
I became a teacher because I was afraid of crowds. And I've been working on it ever since. But for the last almost 50 years, I've really had an interesting trip. And if it's all right with you, I'd like to share some of that with you. First off, I'd like to say how grateful I am for David and his crew. They go back quite a ways. In fact, back to 19th of April, 1976. I looked in my records and found a letter that I'd written to myself because I just had a meeting with David. But they've been great friends. We've had a lot of experiences together. And when I mean experiences, that means that we've been educated together and grown a lot together and those things with that. And I appreciate it, and I appreciate the opportunity to be here and share a few things with you today. I'd like to start back a little further, though. There's a couple here probably older than I am, but most of you aren't. My granddad, I grew up in central Utah, about 50 miles south of Salt Lake. My granddad was a brick mason, done concrete work, had some mixers. Did concrete burial vaults. And my dad picked up on the same thing and did the same sorts of things. And later on when I come along, my brothers, we made concrete burial vaults by hand. The mixer was there and the sand and gravel was there and we mixed it and we put it. And when we got old enough to have, this before you got a driver's license, when you got old enough to have a driver's license, then you picked these things up that weighed about a ton and put them in the back of a pickup and went and put them in the grave. And put the greens around them and did all that. And so at a very early age, I learned to do a little bit of concrete work. Very enjoyable. As we got a little older, my dad started his own brick mason company. And that means that his boys were good hod carriers. As we got a little older, we tried the practice of laying brick. So the time I was out of high school, I was laying brick full time. And that served a purpose for a number of years. Somebody asked my dad one day, he said, how on earth did you get your sons to go to college? My dad said, oh, that was easy. I worked them so darn hard in the summer, they wanted to go to college. You know, there's a lot of truth to that. When I wasn't busy doing something else, I was laying brick. But just as I got out of high school, he happened to have a job down in St. George, about 260 miles away, and he had a little semi. I say little, it hauled 15 ton of brick or block, whatever was on it. But I only averaged 25 miles an hour on the road. No freeways, thank heavens. But I took that little truck, and he stuck me on there because I turned 18 and I could legally drive it. And from the day school's out to the day school stopped, I worked my tail off. At one point before this, I decided, you know, being a truck driver probably is not too bad of a job. After that summer, no way I wouldn't be a truck driver. So all you do is shift them up, shift them down all day long, and it's not much fun. My older brother and sister had gone to school, college, a little bit. They didn't know what they were doing, and I didn't know what I was doing, but I didn't have to haul brick. So I went to college. And I didn't know what to do in college because they didn't even have a technology program. This is a university. They had a pre-engineering program. I said to myself, must be something like engineering. Pre-engineering must be something like laying brick. That's about as far as I knew about that. So I started in the engineering program. And a good wrestling program kept me in college, and so I kept going. And my wife and I got married, and we started raising a family while we were doing this. And so I was laying brick in the summers and going to college. And they started an engineering program the first year after I started this pre-engineering program. A professor came, and they started going, and they decided on a five-year Bachelor of Engineering Science degree. Well, I just kept going. I liked challenges, and that was a good challenge. And I finally got that five-year degree completed. We had four children by then. I had a job offer in Los Angeles. I'd been to Los Angeles twice in that semi, and I decided there was nothing in Los Angeles that I left behind, and that wasn't a place I wanted to go. But that was the only job offer. I thought of laying brick again, too. And about the time I had to really make up my mind, we had to make up our mind, the university came to me and said, would you consider teaching, become an instructor of civil engineering? And I said to myself, wow, that's close to home. And it's not Los Angeles. So I took that job. 40 years later, I retired from that job. But I sure had a lot of fun along the way. I really enjoyed it. When I finished, I started teaching, and a couple years later, they started a master's program. And so while I was teaching full-time, I completed a master's program. The thesis I did was on hyperbolic paraboloids. Now, most of you don't know what that is. That's a double curved surface. The back end of a 56 shiv's got a hyperbolic paraboloid double curved surface. They were just getting popular, starting around the country. They have a rectangular or a square plan on the ground, but they're double curved. So I made some several 10 foot by 10 foot, 1 inch thick hyperbolic paraboloids that sit on one center column. And I load tested these. Now, one of those took 250 pounds a square foot. That's pretty healthy. And I pre-stressed them. I was into pre-stressing, and so I pre-stressed the outside. And one of these I loaded down to where it had some big cracks ready to collapse. When I took the load off, those cracks all closed right up. So I went and got my dad's truck and rigged up a gin pole, and I picked that thing up and took it home, and it became a patio out in my backyard for the next 20 years. I didn't like to waste things either. But I got into hyperbolic paraboloids. And about then, Professor Harry Hodson, who I did my master's work under and took some undergraduate classes, come along and he said, would you like to come and help me? Somebody's trying to build an ice skating rink in Provo. And I'd had a little experience, and he'd done one dome in Australia before he'd come to America. But I'd taken a few classes from him, and we got together, and sure enough, they wanted to build this Olympic-sized ice skating rink back in 1961. And we talked about it, and we talked about it, and how to do it, and all these things, and he decided to do a mathematical analysis. By the way, we don't have any computers at this time. Nobody's written any programs. And so if you remember your math just a little bit, he was trying to use elliptical integrals. This is some advanced calculus, advanced math. And he really struggled. He finally got some answers and was starting to feel about what should be going on. And we talked together and says, well, golly, we really ought to do a model and load test this model. And you know what happened? About that time, he ended up taking a job at the Austin Company back in the Chicago area and left. And left me. So I built a model. And if you haven't done any model analysis, if you take a 12th scale model of a dome that's 240 feet long, this thing's 20 feet. I mean, this model is 20 feet long. It's a great big dollhouse. My kids have really had fun with this. It's only 3/8 of an inch thick in concrete. That dome there is 3.5 inches thick, but you divide that by 12, and it's got some wire mesh in there that's trying to simulate the steel that's in here. And I load tested that to failure. Now I've got to tell you an experience. Here's this dome, and I drilled some little holes in it and put a little block of wood on top and a wire down, and I hung brick on it. Crossed them back and forth, and I stacked the brick up inside. And I drilled these holes and put all the brick I could. Well, I went through my mind, you know, if you want to crawl inside this thing and look around, you better be safe. And so I went inside and put a pillar of concrete block on each end with a plank across the top that was just under the roof. That's an ellipse, and so it's pretty flat, just in case. And then I crawled in and out between them brick as I was loading it and saw where the cracks were coming and just trying to get a feel for what was going on. We didn't know what to do with the entrances, and so I had three different types of entrances on there. Some worked, this one worked, two others didn't work. You're never quite sure what's going to happen, so you try some different things. And I crawled in and out of there and in and out of there, and I kept loading more on there, and pretty soon I couldn't get any more brick on the inside. So I started putting sand on top. One night I went home, and when I come back the next day, it had caved in. And those concrete pillars I'd put up there and that plank didn't even slow it down a second. It just sheared right through there. And I thought to myself, whew, you'd have been a lot shorter if you'd stayed in there. One of those experiences, and we learn as we go, but we have to be careful as we go as well. This particular pitch, this dome was done in 1961 as an ice skating rink. It's 240 feet long, it's 160 feet wide, and it's 40 feet high, 3.5 inches thick on top. Technically, it's called an affined transformation of an ellipsoid. The architect looked at me and said, triaxial ellipsoid. So it became a triaxial ellipsoid. It's like a football cut in half. It's an ellipse that's been stretched. Provo City, when this was built, come back and they went to a local engineer and they said, we've got this thing that we don't know what to do. We've never seen one. We've never heard about one. We ought to have some sort of a check. And the local engineer, the guy that happened to start the civil engineering department, he looked at him and he says, well, why don't you just make them load test it? Well, I got a phone call and said, engineer, you got to test that thing. So I called up the local block plant and I said, can we rent some 12-inch concrete block? And we finally agreed on that. So they start hauling out semi-loads of 12-inch concrete block, and you can see that crane on the end. He's got a pallet of block, about 2,500 pounds, that he's picking up and setting on top. Hired a bunch of students from the university to come and move them and spread them around. Right there is 188,000 pounds of 12-inch concrete block. You can look at the day. It was a nice, beautiful day when we started, and I had a great big power pole across the street the other direction with a survey instrument on top of the here and a rod on top of there, and I was measuring the deflection. And as you plot the deflection, it was going down and going down. The more load, it was going down, a nice straight line. and it was cloudy, and the sun come out. The net deflection was up. That tells you something about these thin shells. They're active, they're alive, and don't try to hook onto them and hold them down with anything because they're going to move. With 188,000 pounds of block on there, the net deflection was up because the sun come out. You have to think about that as you get working with these things. Bigger they are, the worse that problem is. Well, that was back in 1971. About the same time the local Lions Club come along and said, we want a pavilion. Can you do us a pavilion? And we got talking and we ended up doing some hyperbolic paraboloid sections. Six sections. I don't have a picture, but it's set on three points. And the intermediate, the 3 points swoop up. So it's a double curved surface going around here, 5,000 square feet. Farm work is very expensive. And so I was thinking then about farm work, a better way to do it, easier way to do it. This one had an earth farm, 40,000 cubic yards of earth. And it happened to be in an old bed, clay bed, where they used to make brick. And so when they got through, they just excavated, filled in the hole. Very economical. That structure cost about $2.35 a square foot in 1961. Now, the size of it and the type, that's probably the cheapest building ever built that way, at least in this country. But these hyperbolic paraboloids, I got thinking, well, forming that is a pain. And so a hyperbolic paraboloid has straight lines generated. If I have two lines in space and I connect this together with straight lines, if those two lines are not parallel to each other, if they're parallel, it forms a flat surface. If they're not parallel, it forms a funny warp surface called a hyperbolic paraboloid. So on this Lions Club Pavilion, if you lay the rebar in the right direction, it's a straight line. And if you lay it in both directions, straight lines, but it forms this funny curve. The Lions Club people started laying all this rebar, and we stretched some cables across there between, also on these straight lines, to hold everything in place. Well, they got all the rebar on, and it looked beautiful. And I got a phone call that said, you better come quick. I said, what's going on? They're shooting concrete. They're, what? I ran down there. They had no supports. And they're trying to put 80 tons of concrete on this thing. Well, the three that already come up had gone up even further, and it was on its way collapsing. But it looked so beautiful. We thought we could just start shooting concrete. And the guy that's shooting concrete, every time he'd fill in the area, it kept sagging, and so he'd fill it in some more. It was supposed to be 2 inches thick, and he had more than 8 inches in places. So they cut it all out, wasted the rebar, volunteer service, see, and hired a contractor, and he and I worked together, and he did it again. Only in this case, he had scaffolding and made some supports underneath, covered it with expanded metal lath, shot it, and then shot up from the other side, and it's still there today. And it was built back in the early 60s. There's a couple more of them around. My father had a little Cessna 120 airplane. And about this same time, he decided to build a little airplane hangar, and it's block walls, 30 by 40. And I said, Dad, why don't you put a hyperbolic paraboloid concrete roof on top? All right. He didn't question me at all. And so we put a truss across the 40 foot for the airplane, and he had lumber and scaffolding, and so we built a form, cast it in place, and I pre-stressed the outside edge of that one also. And it was there for about 35 years. They remodeled the airport, tore it down, and put some other things around, but it worked beautiful. Kurt Olson. Good friend from a long time ago, and back in 1974, April of 74. He was down in southern Mexico. He worked some special programs for the university, and a colleague of mine, Glenn Collard, had been down a year before doing some things, working with him, and they decided to do a 30 by 40 hyperbolic paraboloid. And so I went down, spent some time down there, earth forms had worked nice, and I'd tried those on my master's thesis and did some different kinds of forms, and the earth form was kind of easiest to handle. So we went out in the middle of this field down there, the other side of Pueblo and Jalisco, was out past Jalisco, and we worked on this, screeded it off to form this double curved surface, had a column up the center, had some local help helping us, and we had a little mixer, and they used 5-gallon buckets to dump in the sand and the gravel and the cement, and we mixed 12 yards of concrete in one day. And you can tell what kind of a day that was if you've been had your hands in concrete very much. Screeded it off with a square point shovel. We only had one wheelbarrow, and it had a steel wheel. That was a long day, but we got it done. And it's still there today. It was jacked up on that column, so it's sitting up off the ground. Kurt says he had to put some braces around it. When the wind blows, it tends to dance. And so he put some center braces to keep this from dancing around, but it's still there today. Well, after all of these hyperbolic paraboloids and this one, one day I got a phone call. This is from a fellow named David South. He says, I read an article about you. You've been doing a little bit with some thin shells. Can I come down and see you? Sure. So he flies down to Provo, and we get together, and he starts telling me about using some air forms. And I could read a little bit about some people trying this in other places. He says, I want to go inside, spray urethane foam, tie the rebar, shoot concrete. And I looked at him and I said, do you know how much concrete weighs when it hits you on the head? That was one of my first reactions. But you know, he had a patent on that, and I got a patent on a different system a year before. But his system was a lot better than mine. I had patented a form system that's just like a big umbrella. I have a shop out in my back that sits on top of 9-foot walls, masonry, because I laid masonry, and a 32-foot dome sitting on top that's post-tensioned around the bottom. No roofing. It's 2.5 or 3 inches thick. An awful, terrible story goes with that, that learning experience. I had a pump truck come, a boom truck that could reach this. Two truckloads of concrete. We had about 16 yards of concrete to do the roof. We had about 3 yards up there and going, and the pump truck broke down. He plugged something up. Took him about an hour. In that hour, clouds rolled in, and it started to hail and snow, and it was a bad day. We sat there until both ready-mix trucks had come. They kept dumping water in the ready-mix so they could get it out of the truck to keep it, because it started setting up on them. And I said, all right, I guess it's it. Go find a place to dump your concrete. And the guy in the pump truck looked at me and says, give it just a few more minutes. Cleared right up. We finished dumping. In fact, we did it so fast, we didn't even get all the hail off of the roof. And you can look inside and you can see a pocket here and there. But we got it done. And it's there today. And it's my shop with round doors on the ends, and it's been a good shop. That was one that led up to the one we did down in Mexico. That was the airplane hangar was the precursor, but these are all coming up around the same time. David come along, though, and he told me about this idea, and he just finished a dome in Shelley, Idaho. And he said, by the way, I had a fellow up here in Idaho do this. Would you just check it for the heck of it? And then by then, I had been teaching a class in the design of concrete thin shells, and some of the students' computers were coming out now. One of my students come to me, he says, is it all right with you if I write a program for this? And I said, sure, go right ahead. Well, he just about flunked the class. He spent day and night trying to write that program and just really struggled. We had punch cards and Fortran and all that kind of stuff. A year or two later, another student comes along, he says, so-and-so tried to write a program. Is it all right with you if I clean up his program and get it working? Sure. Well, he just about flunked the class too. And he worked his tail out. You know, over the years, I hired several other students. they had better computer skills as years went on. And over the years, we finally ended up with a good set of computer programs using the exact solution that's found in Billington's book. And I made them part of the book that's out here, just so that they're available. But they're written in Fortran, so if you try to do something else, you'll have to remember back a ways. But David got me involved in a journey that I never dreamed of, never expected, couldn't have thought of it if I'd have worked hard and tried. I checked out his dome and I says, whatever you do, David, don't uncover the footing. I don't think it'll stand up. It was just a little light in that spot. But over the years, all of a sudden, there's been hundreds and hundreds all over the world. Talk about being in the right place at the right time. And he sold franchises to several others, and I got involved with them. I was talking to a fellow one day and found out that I designed a 140-foot diameter dome for him, and he built 40 of them. He was a licensed engineer, so he just stuck his stamp on the others. But it's been a marvelous journey, and I blame David for a lot of that. Hasn't always been successful, but it sure has been a learning experience, no matter what you say. And back before David got going and before I put my patent out, a fellow came to me and he says, I want to build a house, and I want to build a dome house. And the earth form had worked good. The hyperbolic paraboloids, we'd used expanded metal lath, and that worked pretty good. So we talked it out and we said, all right, let's build a cage of steel, this 48-foot diameter dome, and it's two stories high, so you got straight walls up about 8 feet, and then this elliptical dome over the top. The ellipse wouldn't stay by itself, and so we had to put some supports right out in the center. Other than that, covered the whole thing with expanded metal lath and the shotcrete from the outside and then from the inside. And there's two of them still standing today. One in Provo, Utah, and one in Salt Lake. Worked out very successful. But the formwork always bothered me, and I had to have an economical formwork, so I designed this umbrella and put my shop in the back. Two of my boys, and they were only about 12 or 13 years old at the time, went to help me when we had the concrete all on and decided to take that form out. 4 hours, that whole thing was stacked out in the yard. In that sense, that form was very successful. And it went up about that fast. But it's fixed in size, and it's very expensive. So if you're going to do an awful lot of them that size, it would work out pretty good. But when David came along with his air forms, that was much better. I used mine 4 times, he's used his a couple thousand times. And it really works nice. And it has great potential yet. Things are just getting started, I think, really. I'll have to tell you about another thin shell. Way back in the early 70s, someone across the country decided to make a concrete canoe. I don't know if we got any canoe paddlers, but concrete canoe, it's a little heavy to ford from here to there. The first one, and we decided to make one. At this point in time, the American Society of Civil Engineers has annual concrete canoe races all over the country. They really make a big deal out of it. Well, the first one we made weighed 800 pounds. It floated, by the way. Just don't tip it over. And in one of our Quonset huts was a big water pond in the bottom, and we went and filled it full of water and put this thing in it, and 6 big guys got in this thing, and it floated just fine. It's in my backyard. It makes a beautiful flower pot. Years later, we got much more inventive, and before I left BYU, that's been 11 years ago, I brought one of them home, and it weighs about 200 pounds, about the same size. There's a lot of things you can do. At the double curved surface, it's very light, it's only about a half inch thick, And we've had canoe races on Utah Lake and up on Great Salt Lake, and they've taken hauled it across the country to the Dakotas and other places. It's been very fun, very successful. One of those thin shells that come along. Life, I got to throw you a quote. This is not originated with me, but I doctored a little bit. Life may lead you where you never expected. And I've been on that journey. However, later you may find it just where you want to be. I found that too. I got a thing in my pocket here. Let's take a look at a couple of these. Straight walls have some advantages and disadvantages. Just a simple house with some straight walls and a dome on top. There are a number of those now. We'll see some of both kinds, but Jack Brunk come along and he says, this is back on the East Coast, he says, I want to build some cement storage. This is 124-foot diameter. It sits on top of 90-foot high straight walls and a sphere on top, and we want to drive 18-wheelers underneath the center, and we want a cone bottom, and whoo, it went on and on. And I got out my paper and my glue and my scissors, and I started to make one. And I probably made two or three. But it's still up, along with several others like that. Somebody's always coming along. Guy called me one day, and he says, I like scuba diving. Can you put one of those domes down under the water? I thought for a little bit and said, sure, why not? In fact, you can even leave the bottom off if you control the pressure very good, so you've got water on the bottom, and you could have some little patios going around so your tables, you're sitting at the table eating and looking at the water. And the scuba divers could come in and out if you want. Hey, it's possible. If you control the water right, the air pressure on the inside. If you don't, you might get wet, but lots of things are possible. And it'll take the pressure from the outside. You can design that. The simple domes, to start with, most of the domes around the country and the world were storage structures. Grain, Portland cement, fertilizer, all kinds of things. If you're dealing with fertilizer, you have to remember that with fertilizer and water, you get acid. Concrete's on this end of the scale, acid's on this end of the scale, and they don't get along good together, so you have to be careful. You either tell your client, because of that, you have a lifespan of this much. If you want to put a coating on the inside that'll keep the moisture out, then you got a lifespan of this much. And I know at least one that turned to mush, and somebody else engineered it and built it. Different system, but years later they called me up and said, we've got this dome that's falling apart. The concrete strength, if you use a Schmidt hammer, that's a rebound hammer that tests the strength, it's less than 1,000 PSI. Some of it's just crumbling. My suggestion was that makes a good form. Build another one over the top. Which I think they did. The concrete is a basic material and you keep it away from the acids. Take a look at what's happened over the years. Architects have gotten involved, churches, schools, houses. They're getting more and more complex and more beautiful and more accepted. You're going to see a couple like this on your tour, I understand. And over the years, they've changed, but they got straight walls on the bottom, a dome on top. And remember that the dome is an animal that breathes in and out. It changes volume and it changes dimensions. So whatever you hook onto there is going to go with it. You want to be careful of that. The general storage structures, there are a lot around. A very stable structure, whether it be wind or whether it be earthquake. See the conveyor on top? These are very small and light. And one day someone asked me about this storage dome. We want this storage dome. And we want to put a conveyor on top. And I said, how much is a conveyor going to load the top? 80,000 pounds. And I said, 80,000 pounds? You know this is a thin shell? Well, you know, there's some up built today that have 10 times that much on top. Hundreds of thousands of pounds. It all depends on how you design that shell and how thick it gets. And they're thin shells, and they're very stout and very strong, and there's lots of them around. Didn't have an entrance on one of those, but in one of the other talks this morning, they're talking about the entrances, and all these forces are coming around here, and you want to come and put a hole through the middle of all those forces. You got to do something with the forces. So you make them go over the top and underneath, and they've got to hook onto something that's rigid enough there that it doesn't move. When they get in these big storage ones, and they look at something that's 10 or 12 feet wide and it's got 50 number 8 bars in it or something like that, they start cussing and blowing and steaming and saying, how are we going to get all this in there? One layer at a time. You tie one layer, you shoot it, you tie another layer, you shoot it, you tie another layer, you shoot it until you get through. Somehow you got to take care of all those forces. Lots of storage structures. I'm not sure that particular complex where that one's at. What does it say? Faith Chapel, Birmingham, Alabama. That's the ones that's about done now, right? These must be the airforms then. Okay. The airforms in place for this complex of 6 very large domes. This is a high school complex, 5 big domes, 3 in front, 2 in behind, all interconnected. Where's that at?
Grand Meadow,
Minnesota, right. I knew that. When you get this old, though, your mind lasts only about that long. It's also a tornado shelter for the community, a safe shelter. And it has all the advantages of energy that David talked about. If you build this, you can get by with enough energy savings to pay for this and not too many years down the road. So I have a very good friend that I went to school with that's on a local school board. And I wrote him a nice letter and went and talked to him and said, you know, Colin, if the school board would get on this, they not only could save a lot of money, they could have more money to pay more teacher salaries. That's always a big deal. The teachers never get paid enough, so they want to pay them more. And they need more room. And I said, you can get all the same room. It won't cost you probably any more to start with. They make some awful fancy schools. Probably cheaper doing it this way. But even if it wasn't, you'll save enough energy to pay for that whole system in the next 20 years. They have local architects that have worked with them for years and years and years, so he sent the letter over to the architect. A month later, I got a letter back, and the architect proved to me on his written paper that it would cost twice as much to build this as it would to build his. And everything else he disagreed with. Of course, he'd been out of job very quickly, too, unless he wanted to delve into something new. Great savings, great energy savings. Very strong, very durable. It doesn't burn. Air conditioner's cheaper. There's lots of advantages to that type of a structure. And you get the architects involved, Rick Crandall and others, who make those pleasingly available looking-wise to the public. I think you're going to see a lot more of them down the future. There are so many advantages, very few disadvantages. Sometimes I like to cut big holes out. When you cut that big hole out, you got to remember at the bottom of the dome, there's tension going all the way around. In the top of the dome, it's compression. But if I cut a big hole through all the tension, then I've got to carry that tension around the hole. So I need to work at that arch around there to carry that tension and to make sure that it's a stable structure. Inside of a crenosphere? Must be an outside of a crenosphere. We've talked and done some research and found that we can build very, very large structures. David called them crenospheres. if I make a dome, let's just take a half sphere. One of the problems I have to consider as they get large is the snap-through buckling. If you inflate a balloon, for example, and poke your finger in it, it makes a big dip. That balloon, that dome is that same type of a structure. It's a little more rigid than the balloon, but if I put a heavy load on there, pretty soon it has a tendency to turn inside out. So one of the things I have to design as an engineer is to take into account that snap-through buckling. As I get bigger, the radius of curvature gets larger, the thickness that I need to stop that buckling increases. Well, when I increase the solid thickness, the weight increases. All of a sudden, I reach a point where the weight increases more than the benefits I'm getting, and it'll self-destruct. So if I want to go very, very large, I've got to do something to cut out the weight. Ribs. I can put ribs up through here, cut out a lot of weight, get the depth I need to take care of that snap-through buckling, and then just have a small shell between the ribs. We went down in the lab, and we'd done some studies. Our lab's only 40 feet wide, so the model we had to only get 40 feet wide. But it worked like a charm. We can make them now very, very large. And use a relatively small inflation pressure rather than a very large inflation pressure. If the inflation pressure gets too large, then the fabric's got to be stronger. There reaches a point where you can't get stronger fabric, so unless you do something else. Well, then you put a cable net over the outside. And then you make the cable strong enough to take the pressure you need for construction, and you let the fabric with a small radius of curvature go between the cables. That worked. So we're convinced now that you can build a crenosphere. How big? I don't know. 1,000 foot. That's a good number. I'd like to start at one at 500 first. That's experience talking, because every time we do something new, darn, there's a learning curve to that. Whether it's putting a coating on or using urethane foam or using an air inflated structure, whatever we do, there's always a learning curve. And if you can come to a conference like this, boy, it saves a lot of learning. It's much cheaper to come and learn from David and his crews and people that have done it before than it is to go out and try it all by yourself. It just has a very high learning curve. We're always learning something new, getting a new experience. One of the things that popped up before we got to here is water tanks. And it can get into oil storage, but we've done 3 water tanks. Now you can call them models, but they all belong to communities. When you're the first, you have a problem. The first one is a 125,000 gallon tank that is a complete ball. That's logical, isn't it? Until they went inside and tried to work on that, and if you ever worked on a curve like that with rebar everywhere, that's a pain in the neck. And so the second one has got a flat bottom and about 3/4 of a curve, 300,000 gallon. And then I really got serious and started to do some studies and found out that there's a point. If I, and then I met a fellow from California that's in the tank building business, with a lot of reputation and done lots and lots. And he come up to the university and was talking to him in my office, and I told him about this idea of building these water tanks. Next time his literature come out, he had one in there, except he had a half sphere. You don't want to build a half sphere. Why? Because water pressure is perpendicular to the surface. And if all the surface is up, every piece has got a vertical lift. It means you just pulled the tank apart. You pulled the bottom off. I called him up on the phone, talked to his son, and I said, by the way, you have this advertisement, don't build one like that, it'll pull the bottom off. Their advertisements since have all gone. They didn't show up again, but it has that problem, and it's a great learning curve if you've never done one. But the third one was a 500,000 gallon tank, so we got 120,000, a 300,000, a 500,000, And this one has got a flat bottom, and you only fill it up about 3/4 of the way, and it works. And it works like a charm. And you use half the concrete that a conventional tank has. Thank you. Great possibilities. Great possibilities. She says I've got 3 minutes left. Let me share one more piece of inspiration. And this is not from me either, but it fit what I have experienced. So let me pass it on to you. This one's from Mother Teresa. If you've been in the construction business or if you've been doing anything in your life, this might ring a bell. It's called Do It Anyway. People are often unreasonable, illogical, self-centered. Forgive them anyway. If you are kind, people may accuse you of selfish, ulterior motives. Be kind anyway. If you're successful, you will win some false friends and some true enemies. Be successful anyway. If you're honest and frank, people may cheat you. Be honest and frank anyway. What you spend years building, someone could destroy overnight. Build anyway. If you find serenity and happiness, they may be jealous. Be happy anyway. The good you do today, people will often forget tomorrow. Do good anyway. Give the world the best you have, and it may never be enough. Give the world the best you have anyway. You see, in the final analysis, it is between you and God. It was never between you and them anyway. Mother Teresa, thank you for letting me come.